From Unconsciousness to Consciousness, Number 4. An Osho talk given spontaneously to an international audience in the USA. Are you a Messiah?
Absolutely no. The whole idea is fundamentally wrong. It is not only that I am not a Messiah, there has never been anyone who was. And there will never be anyone who will be. You will have to go deep into the concept of it. The idea of Messiah is a secondary idea. First, you have to believe in God as a person. Then only you can start thinking of God sending special messengers, messiahs. To me, there is no personal God at all. Who can send the Messiah? I am reminded of a very beautiful incident in one of the most famous Muhammadan Khalif, Umar. The Khalif in Mohammedanism is parallel to the Pope in Christianity. He is both the religious head and the temporal head. Umar was a very nice and good man. One day, his soldiers brought a man to his court who was claiming to be God's latest messenger. The Mohammedan word for it is Peygamber. Mohammedans believe Muhammad is the last Peygamber, the last word God has sent. Now there is no need of any other Peygamber. This is a vicious logic. A very strange thing millions of people go on believing without even raising a simple question. In the book Quran, which Muhammad says is God's message to him, it has descended upon him. He is not its writer, just only a receiver. And Quran says that Muhammad is the last Paygamber, and there will be no need for any other Paygamber anymore. So Mohammedans are very much against anybody saying that he is a Paygamber. Umar told his soldiers, that put him into the jail, give him 7 days time to think, and after 7 days I will come to the jail. If he still insists to be the Paygamber, then he will be beheaded immediately. If he takes his words back, he will be released. After 7 days of immense torturing, the man was bound by a pole and beaten continuously, day and night. Very few moments were given to sleep, and very small food was given to eat. Just in 7 days, Umar could not recognize that he is the same man. They had tortured and beaten him so much, and he was chained into a pillar, naked, all over body. The blood, because he was being whipped so hardly. Umar asked, I hope you must have come to your senses back. The man laughed and said, what are you talking about? This has proved that I am the latest Paygamber, the latest messenger. Because when I was leaving God, he said to me that you will be tortured, beaten. And it has come true. Umar could not believe. And just then another man who was tied to another pole and has been tortured for 1 month continuously shouted, Umar, don't believe in this man. He is absolutely lying. I have not sent him as my last messenger. Because 1 month before, this man was caught declaring himself God. These people are megalomaniacs. It is a certain mind disease. You want to be superior, higher than everybody else. You would like to be a president of a country, a prime minister of a country, a king, a queen, but it is difficult. There is so much competition. And only one man can become a president in the whole country, and the whole country is burning deep down, desiring to be higher above everybody's head, to be somebody special, unique. Now, these kind of people can find very easy ways now to declare oneself a messiah. There is no election for it. You don't need anybody's sanction for it. You can write a book in which you can declare that you are the messiah. This is the circular argument. The book is true because it is written by a messiah. And you are a messiah because it is written in a true book. What other evidence Jesus has for being a messiah? Except his own statements. What Christians have to prove that Jesus is a Messiah? Because it is written in the New Testament. And the New Testament is nothing but this man's statements. Do you see the circular argument? They are true because they are from the Messiah. And he is Messiah because it is written in the true book. Jesus was not such a bad man that he should be crucified. His only crime was that he declared himself a Messiah. That too is nothing to be bothered. Somebody thinks he is a messiah. He is doing no harm to anybody. Let him enjoy. But the Jews could not tolerate it. So I will have to go deep into the whole concept and its history. Moses is responsible for Jesus' crucifixion. Nobody has said before it. Because the distance between Moses and Jesus is 3,000 years. But I say to you, Moses is responsible for Jesus' crucifixion for two reasons. First, he declares that a Messiah is going to come and he will solve all your problems, all your difficulties. This was pure politics. Jews were slaves in Egypt. Moses was a great charismatic leader. Certainly one of the greatest leaders the world has known. He convinced these slaves that they can be free. Not only that, but they are the chosen people of God. These slaves were in a way perfectly satisfied the way they were there. It was not a very comfortable situation. They were poor. Their humanity was almost crushed. They were not treated like human beings. They were treated worse than animals. And continuous labor, a futile kind of labor. You see these pyramids. All these pyramids were created by the Jews. Even scientists today are puzzled because how such huge stones were carried from miles away because there is no quarry around. The quarries are miles away. How such huge stones were carried? There were no cranes. There were no technology possible. They were carried just by human beings, Jews. And then to put those stones on top of each other and to make a huge sky-high pyramid was almost an impossible task. It was made possible by continuously whipping the slaves. So Jews were carrying the stones. One stone may be carried by perhaps 40, 50 people. And on horses around them were Egyptians continuously beating them so that they don't stop. People were dying and being replaced immediately by other slaves. How many people died in creating one pyramid is difficult to calculate now. Millions of people died in creating those stupid pyramids, which are utterly meaningless. But the ego of man. Each Egyptian king and queen wanted his grave. Those are graves. His grave to be the biggest, the highest, the most precious. And each king and queen, because they were not certain that after their death, their successors will make so much effort. And a pyramid is not made in one day. Rome may be made in one day, but pyramids are not made in one day. So each king and queen were making the moment they were enthroned. They started digging their grave, preparing, because it would take 30 years, 40 years, 50 years for the pyramid to be made. Millions of people will die. Moses must have been a tremendously powerful leader, that he convinced these slaves that you can drop out of this slavery, that you are not made for this. On the contrary, you are a master race. You are the chosen few of God. This was such a great quantum leap from being a slave to becoming a master race. Moses did the miracle. But it is easy to convince people, give them dreams, beautiful dreams, give them hope, give them utopias, but to fulfill them is not so easy. And Moses recognized it very soon. He took the slaves out of Egypt, giving them the hope that soon we will reach our cherished land, Israel. There you will be all blissful and happy, and you will have all the comforts. 40 years they wandered in the Middle East desert. There was no Israel. In those 40 years of wandering, they suffered more than they had ever suffered in Egypt. You will be surprised to know that out of 4 persons, 3 persons died. By the time Moses decided to stop near Jerusalem, he has lost almost all the people. Only 1/4 of the original people were left. 40 years is a long time. The people who were young became old and died. In fact, these were new children who were born on the way and were now young. They had no idea about Egypt. They had only seen the suffering of wandering in the desert. If you have wandered in a desert, you will understand what it means to wander for 40 years without food, without water, just begging whenever you can find some people, somewhere, some caravan, some oasis. People died of hunger, people died of thirst. People simply died because they were dragging themselves in the sands year after year. 40 years is a long time. And remember, it was not that Moses had found Israel that he stopped. He stopped because he was also now fed up. He had to stop somewhere. Now he understood it is very easy to provoke people, to give them beautiful dreams, to encourage them, to fill them with hope, but it is very difficult to materialize. So he had to give them new hopes again. That is the only opium that keeps people somehow dragging and living. So he said, don't be worried. Our efforts are not wasted. We have reached the land. And what land he had reached? Jerusalem is nothing. It is a desert. And people were thinking of rivers of honey and rivers of milk. They were thinking of paradise. That's the way Moses has painted it to them. And when they stopped at Jerusalem, almost dead, because they were refusing to move anymore. Enough is enough. 40 years you have been dragging and you have been pushing them and saying that we are reaching. It is just close by, just few days more. Few people became so frustrated that they left Moses' group. That is what is called the last tribe. It was not last. They simply slipped away. Seeing the futility of the whole, they slipped away, and by chance they reached a better place. They reached Kashmir in India. Moses himself was tired. His people were tired. He gave them again hope. That's all that leaders can do. And leaders have been doing always only that. The opium called hope. That tomorrow is going to be better. Forget the yesterdays. They are finished. And don't be too much worried about today. It is fading away. Tomorrow, let tomorrow come. And everything will be all right. But that tomorrow never comes. Moses did the same. He said, don't be worried, we have found the place. He knew deep in his heart that he has failed, utterly failed. That knowingly, unknowingly, he has cheated these poor people. They were in poverty and they were in suffering, but not in such suffering, in such poverty as they are now. But he could not confess it. To say it would have been very fatal. So what he did, he said, "We have found the place. I am now old. The Messiah will come soon. God has promised me. He will be sending the Messiah who will redeem you, who will be your salvation." And just to hide his face diplomatically, he said that I have to go back and look for the lost tribe. It was a simple strategy to escape from the reality that was in front of them. No paradise has opened its doors, and people were becoming angry. Perhaps they would have killed Moses. There was a danger, because this is the man who has created the whole trouble. Otherwise, they were somehow living and they were satisfied and they have accepted their fate. I know poor people, utterly poor, who have nothing. It is so difficult for them even to manage one meal a day. Sometimes they have just to drink water and sleep. Water to fill the empty belly so they can feel that something is there. But they are in a certain way satisfied. They have accepted it as their fate. They don't think things can be better than this. You can provoke them. You can put the fire in their mind very easily. Just give them hope. But then sooner or later they are going to hold you by your neck, that where are the hopes? And that was the situation after 40 years when Moses left them. The excuse was that I am going to find the people who have lost somewhere. He never came back. He died in India. I have been to his grave. You will be surprised to know that it is such a great coincidence that Moses and Jesus both died in India. And the graves of both are in one place in Kashmir. The people who had escaped from the pilgrimage, which was miles long, they found a better place. Perhaps if Moses has turned towards Kashmir, he would have been able to tell his people that this is paradise. It is paradise. It is so beautiful, so utterly beautiful, that the people who had escaped, they never bothered again where the whole company has gone, where Moses is. They simply settled in Kashmir. Kashmir is Jewish. They were forced later on to become Mohammedans. And they became Mohammedans. But you can see their faces. Their behavior. And it is so apparent that they don't belong to India. They are not Aryans and they are not Mohammedans. They are Jews. Just few days before, Indira Gandhi has been assassinated. She is a descendant of those Jews. You can see in her nose. Only Moses is solely responsible for giving the idea of a Messiah who will come. And then many claim to be the Messiah. Jesus is not the only one. Many others. And they all suffered. Jesus was the most outrageous. And he claimed that he is the promised Messiah. This was the crime. Why Jews thought it a crime, I feel perhaps they were right. I cannot say they were right in crucifying Jesus. I cannot support any violence. And this was just absolutely unwanted. They could have tolerated, let him. He was moving on his donkey, declaring himself the Messiah. You could have laughed, enjoyed. That seems to be right. And what following he had? Just few people, uneducated, uncultured, who got caught into his net, that he will redeem them, that he will show them the path and lead them to God. But very few, not even hundreds, he could have been tolerated. He was not in any way a danger to Judaism. But I can understand why Jews could not tolerate this man. Otherwise, he was just a buffoon. They could have laughed at the whole thing, that look at the Messiah with his donkey and 12 stupid followers. He is the Messiah, the promised one. But there is a psychological reason why they had to crucify this man. They wanted their hope not to be disturbed. They will never accept anybody as a Messiah. Remember, since Jesus also, few others have tried. But Jews will never accept anybody as the Messiah, because to accept somebody as the Messiah means losing the hope. And they have suffered so much that the hope is the only treasure they have. Jesus is a nice fellow, but not psychologically balanced. Otherwise, he would have tried to help people to become more integrated, more grounded, more centered, more meditative. He should have worked to share if he had anything. There was no need to declare himself a Messiah and call an unnecessary crucifixion. There seems to be some kind of suicidal element in him. He was perfectly aware the day he was crucified was not unexpected. He knew it before in the Last Supper with his apostles. He had said himself that tomorrow they are going to catch me. That tomorrow I am going to be crucified. Then what was the need to go to Jerusalem? If you had already known the fact that they are waiting there to crucify you, there was no need for him to go to Jerusalem at all. But he is pulled like a magnet, pulling a piece of metal. He is pulled towards his crucifixion. There seems to be a suicidal tendency in him. And he, at least I cannot forgive him for that. He was only 33. After 70, it's okay. One can enjoy the idea of dying. But at the age of 33, it is the prime of life. And he had only been teaching for 3 years. What can you do in 3 years? How many people he had convinced? How many people he had with him? in 3 years, he had not even been able to give a philosophic system. An entire ideology, a methodology for man's transformation, nothing. What he has given are very simple maxims, which are more or less adopted from the wisdom of the ages. They are not new. There is nothing novel in it. Yes, he says again and again that the old prophets have said to you, that follow the law of tit for tat, or something like that. But I say to you, that if somebody hits you on one cheek, give him the other cheek. I say to you, love your enemy just as you love yourself. They look profound, but they are not very original. He had traveled up to his 30th year into Egypt, in India, in Ladakh, into the Himalayas. I have been to Ladakh and I have seen the ancient library of Ladakh Lamasari, which has a record of all the visitors who has visited the Lamasari. Lamasari is the Buddhist monastery in Ladakh. Jesus is one of the visitors. And his whole personality is described perfectly. His time, his age, how he looked, what essentially his teaching was, everything is described. And scientists have looked into those old pages. They are leaves of a certain tree. They are exactly 2,000 years old. They are not new. So he was gathering all this from outside sources. Hence he looked very new to the Jews. But to me he cannot look new. Before him Buddha has been talking about love, and Mahavira has been talking about love. 500 before Jesus, a Lao Tzu in China was talking about love. And what he is saying is almost the same. It would have been new if he had added something through his experience. For example, I would like to say to you, Jesus says, love your enemy just as you love yourself. First, you don't love yourself, remember. That is the last person in the world you love. So to say to a person, love your enemy just as you love yourself, is strange because nobody loves himself. Have you ever thought about it? Do you love yourself? Have you any respect for yourself? Forget about love. Forget about respect. Do you even accept yourself as you are? There is condemnation. You would like to be somebody else. You don't want to be yourself. Not at all. Jesus has not thought about it at all, what he is saying. It is easier to love the enemy than to love yourself. It is not so difficult to love your enemy because it makes you feel so higher, so superior, so special. But to love oneself, you don't become superior. You don't even look at yourself. You have not even looked within you what you have been carrying. What you have been carrying from the very birth. What is it that you are? Have you ever tried to face it? And secondly, anybody who is really original and thinking about love will have to know one thing, that you can love only if you are capable of hate. You cannot love if you become incapable of hate. You can love somebody because you are capable of hating somebody else. You have a friend, that's why you can have an enemy. You cannot destroy hate completely and just save love. They are two sides of the same coin. When hate disappears, love also disappears. That is my experience. Buddha also says, love and don't hate. Jesus also says, love, don't hate. Mahavira also says, love, don't hate. But I say to you, if you don't hate, you cannot love. All these people are just talking intellectually. They have not looked into the energy of love and hate, that they are one energy. Love is standing upside down becomes hate. It is just standing on its head, that's all. It is not a different thing. So when hate disappears, I am saying to you from my own experience, when hate disappears, love disappears too. And what is left is just compassion. You cannot call it love. Love is too passionate a word, too hot a word. What is left when love and hate are gone, and love and hate it would be better if I say love hate and drop the end, because they are not two things. When love hate disappears, then the energy that is left is compassion. It has no attachment. It is neither love nor hate. It has no friends and no enemies. Neither Buddha has understood it, nor Mahavira, nor Jesus. So in 3 years what he was doing, in 30 years whatsoever he has collected by roaming around the then known world, he was just parrot-like saying it, without having any insight into it. But because he was saying so many beautiful words, he became hypnotized by his own words and started thinking that he is the Messiah for whom the Jews have been waiting. And Jews are never going to accept anybody. Even if Moses comes again, they are not going to accept him as the Messiah, because for a simple psychological reason, to accept somebody as a Messiah means dropping the hope for the future. Then there is no tomorrow. Then there is no more utopia. They had to crucify Jesus just to save their hope. The hope was far more significant than crucifying a Jew who was going to die anyway. But he should not be allowed to disturb the hope of the whole race. So it will not be very correct to be absolutely against the priests of the great temple of Jews who decided for the crucifixion of Jesus. Because this man was destroying their hope, their dream land. They have nothing. In the time of Jesus, they were under the rule of Rome. They were again slaves. They have escaped from Egypt for nothing. All that suffering, all those 40 years of immense suffering and pain. And what they have gained? Israel was again under the Roman Empire. They were again slaves, again paying taxes to the Romans, again being beaten by the Romans, again being treated like slaves, animals by the Romans, subhuman. They had only one thing, a hope that the Messiah will come and he will redeem us from all our miseries. Now this man says that I am the Messiah, and they know he cannot redeem them of their miseries. They know him who he is. And when they crucified him, they were asking him, now redeem yourself. Ask your God. Ask the God you have been talking about continuously and saying that I am the only begotten Son of God. Ask him now, Father, help me. This is the moment to do the miracle. When such a moment will come again, when your only begotten Son will be crucified. But the sky is silent. No answer comes. There is nobody to answer you. It was your hallucination that you are God's only begotten Son. It was your dream in which you started believing, because few foolish people started believing in your words, and you started believing in their belief in you. On the cross, it became clear that the sky is empty and there is no answer to your prayer. And Jesus says, look, this is the Messiah who was going to redeem the whole humanity. He cannot redeem himself. I am not a Messiah. I don't give you any hope. And I would like emphatically for you to remember that nobody else can redeem you. The whole idea is wrong. You have created your bondage. How can I make you free? You throw your bondage and be free. You love your chains. And you want me to redeem you. you are asking an absurdity. You are the cause of your miseries, sufferings. And you want me to redeem you from your sufferings and miseries? And you will go on sowing the same seeds, continuing being the same old person, watering the same causes. Who can redeem you? And why anybody should redeem you? It is not my responsibility to redeem you. I have not made you what you are. You have made yourself what you are. So my function here is not that of a Messiah who simply says, believe in me and you are redeemed. A very simple strategy. You have nothing to do with your personality change, transformation. You have nothing to do at all. You just believe in me. Don't let any doubt arise. Now, this is the whole strategy of belief. You cannot avoid doubt. Wherever belief exists, doubt is simply suppressed. If there is no doubt, you don't need any belief. It is because of the doubt that you need belief, to suppress it, to cover it. And the condition is that there should be no doubt. You should believe me without any doubt, and I will redeem you. Neither you can fulfill the condition, nor you can ask me why I am not redeemed. The condition is such that it cannot be fulfilled. And I am free to say that you have not fulfilled the basic condition. The contract has not been fulfilled. From your side, what can I do? You believe me indubitably, which is absolutely impossible. Nobody can do it. It is not in the nature of things. Belief exists always hand in hand with doubt. It exists for doubt. I have no belief at all in anything because I don't have any doubt at all about anything. If there is no doubt, there is no need for belief. The disease is not there, medicine is not required. You go on pouring belief, more belief, but you are simply repressing doubt deeper and deeper into your unconscious. And the deeper it goes, more dangerous it is, because you will become unaware of it. One day you will think that you believe, you are a believer, that you have attained to faith, because your doubt has gone so deep in your dark unconscious that you cannot see it anymore. I would like you to see your doubt clearly. Rather than repressing it by any belief system, bring it out into the conscious mind. Face it. And just by facing your doubt, it dissolves. No belief is needed. It simply evaporates. It is not to be substituted by a belief. If you substitute it by a belief, then you are in a very strange dilemma. Just scratch a little bit your belief, and there is doubt flowing fully alive. Skin deep is the belief, and underneath your blood is flowing. So basically, my standpoint is you are responsible for whatsoever you are. If you are miserable, you are responsible. Don't throw the responsibility on anybody else, otherwise you will never be free of it. Because how can you be free? If I am responsible for your misery, then unless I free you, you cannot be free. It is in my hands. And if it is in my hands, it can be in somebody else's hands. Those who are with me have to understand it, howsoever hard and painful it is, that you and you alone are responsible for everything that is happening to you, has happened to you, will happen to you. Once you accept all your responsibility in its totality, you become mature. You stop throwing tantrums and you stop seeking for messiahs. Then there is no need for any Jesus to save you. Neither any Jesus can save you. He was exploiting your situation. Jews did not allow him to disturb their hope, their dream, their future. Jews have suffered the most in the world. Hence, they need hope more than anybody else. And they have been clinging with the idea that the Messiah will come. And these are only few days of suffering. And nothing to be compared when the Messiah comes and redeems you. And you will be the chosen few of God. And all else who are enjoying now, are not suffering now, will be thrown into hell. A good consolation. Jesus was disturbing their consolation, their hope. Naturally, they became angry. Otherwise, he was not a dangerous man at all. But he certainly has the mind of a megalomaniac. I am just an ordinary man. In the same reference, I would like to tell you few things which are related and have been asked to me again and again. Hindus have asked me. Bhagwan, are you an avatara of God? An incarnation of God? Just as Jews believe in the Messiah, Hindus believe that their sufferings will end, their poverty, their misery, when God descends in the form of an avatara as Krishna, as Rama. They have been asking me and I have been telling to them, no, not at all, because you are so idiotic. Rama has been there. Your sufferings have not changed. Krishna has been there. Your sufferings have not changed. Still you are asking. And I tell you, neither Krishna was a avatara nor Rama was a avatara. It is their megalomania and your hope mixed together that creates the whole thing. The Jainas have asked me, are you a Tirthankara? That is their hope, their word for Messiah. And you will be surprised. And that's what makes me very sick. Mahavira is the 24th Tirthankara of Jainas. They have this fixed number of 24. Now, there was so much competition in Mahavira's time. There were 8 people, contemporaries of Mahavira. Gautam Buddha is one of those 8 who were all insisting that we are the 24th Tirthankara. And they were all criticizing the remaining 7. Their criticisms are not rational. Their criticisms are more abusive. For example, even Buddha, that's what I say, it makes me feel sick. Even Buddha, whom I respect in many ways, but in many ways, I can't respect him. He was claiming that I am the real Tirthankara, not Mahavira. Mahavira was old. Buddha was young. Mahavira was almost established. Buddha was making the ground. If he had criticized Mahavira rationally, scientifically, I would have loved it. But that is not what he does. He tries to make Mahavira a laughing stock. Because jainas say that the Tirthankara is omniscient, all the qualities of God. Omniscient, he can see all, past, present, future. Omnipresent, he can be present anywhere, or can be present simultaneously everywhere. Omnipotent, that he has absolute power upon everything. Buddha could have criticized him that to claim such qualities seems to be egoistic. And the ego is the first thing that has to be dropped on the path. You are, rather than dropping it, making it bigger and bigger and bigger. So big that it is going to burst. Buddha makes a laughing stock of Mahavira. He says, what kind of omnipotence is it? Because Mahavira had in his old age, he was 82, walking on his feet for 40 years continuously, eating only once in a while, one day he will eat and then 7 days or 10 days he will not eat. It was bound to happen that he will disturb his whole system of digestion. And that's what happened. At the age of 82, his whole digestive system simply collapsed. He died, perhaps, of a stomach ulcer, cancer, something. Nobody knows, but something to do with the stomach. The stomach simply failed to function. He was responsible, nobody else is responsible for it. In the night, the Jaina monk cannot drink water. And in the hot country like India, and the hottest part, Bihar, even in the hot summer, the moment sun goes down, nothing can go down in your stomach. No food, no water, nothing. And only one time you have to eat, and that too is standing, not sitting, because that is too luxurious and comfortable. If he looks at my chair, he will go mad. He will simply freak out. He used to eat standing and he cannot use any thing. So only his hands. No pot, no utensils, nothing. Because that is possession. And he does not possess anything. So he has to use his hands as a cup. And the food is given in the hands and he eats it. It is uncomfortable, very uncomfortable, because both the hands are there. Now how you eat? I have tried, not succeeded. Not really, just before a mirror. Not with any food in my hand. But when your both hands are engaged in holding the food, then you have to eat like, just like an animal. Directly from the mouth, you cannot. And you cannot eat much, because only one time you can have how much you can hold in your hands. You have to drink water that way. He was naked. These were qualities prescribed by the ancient tradition of jhanas for a Tirthankara. And he was fulfilling each quality, whatsoever the cost. And every day you cannot get food, because the Tirthankara in the morning, doing his meditation, makes a note in his mind that today I will accept food at a certain house only if certain conditions are fulfilled. Strange things you can manage, and nobody, you have to tell them that two bananas should be hanging in the door. Only then you will accept food, otherwise you will not accept. Now everybody can go bananas and nobody will be able to find. So sometimes 10 days will pass and he will go around the town and he will not find his condition fulfilled. That is thought to be by the jhanas, that existence does not want you to take food today. It's strange. Then why you feel hungry? Why you went in the first place? If existence does not want you to take food today, there should not be hunger. Why you went in the first place? If I meet him somewhere, I will ask him, why you went? If existence itself does not want, there will be no hunger and you will not have any urge to go around. You were hungry. It is absolutely certain you went around the town, but you had a strange condition and that was in your mind, and people are not mind readers. Now don't throw the responsibility on poor people. Sometimes by coincidence it will happen. Then he will take food. No, this is a sure way to disturb your whole system of digestion, intestines. And that's what happened. But he was a very strong man, so he could manage long. But how long you can go against nature. Finally, his stomach collapsed. Now, rather than arguing the point, Buddha simply makes Mahavir a laughing stock, that if he is omnipotent, then why he cannot cure his stomach? Then why the physician is to be asked? He is omnipotent. He is omniscient. He must have seen it before it happened, because he knows past, present, future. But Buddha laughs and says that I have seen Mahavira begging in front of a house in which nobody lives. And he knows past, present and future. And he does not know that the house is empty, that there is nobody inside. That he had stabbed in the early morning when it is not light enough on the tail of a dog. And only when the dog starts jumping and barking at him, then he comes to know. And he is omniscient. He knows past, present, future. And he does not know the dog just in front of him. These are not arguments. These are below Gautama Buddha. But the same is the situation with Mahavira. Mahavira never criticized Buddha for the simple reason because Buddha had no established name yet. He was young. And Mahavira did not bother about this man. But about others who were more established than Mahavir, before Mahavir, who were older than Mahavir, he was behaving in the same way, even worse. Makhli Gosal was another competitor for the 24th Tirthankara, because now the line was going to be closed. After 24th, there is not going to be 25th. Just, I managed one idiot. He is a Jaina monk. He was, because Jainas throw him out. I convinced him that if there can be 24, why not 25th? What is wrong in being 25th? And day in and day out, I continued to argue about the 25th. I said, you declare you are the 25th. And he declared. His name is Swami Satyabhakt. He declared, and the moment he declared, the Jainas threw him out, that you are not even a Jaina. 25th he came running to me that you convinced me that I am the 25th. I said, I don't take any responsibility. I simply argued. It was you who became convinced. That means you had been carrying the seed of it. You wanted, but you were not courageous enough to say it. And I simply brought it up. It was your, otherwise you would have said that I am satisfied. I don't want to be 25th. I have been trying it on other people also. They have not been caught. So I am not responsible. Now he is very angry, because since then Jainas have not allowed him back into the community. He has asked to be forgiven that, but such a man, to the Jainas, it is just like the Jews were against Jesus. Jainas at least have not crucified him. They simply threw him away, took away the symbols of Jaina monk, and said him that if you say it again, we will drag you to the court. Because in our tradition, there can be nobody 25th. But he is such an idiot. I said, you do one thing. You say Mahavira was not the real 24th. You are the 24th. He said, great. This idea never happened to me. I said, but remember, I will not take the responsibility of it. Because this time they will beat you. 25th, they have simply thrown you out that you are crazy. But if you say that Mahavira was not the real 24th, it was just a misunderstanding for 25 centuries that Jainas have believed in his, and it was contested by 8 people, so there is no problem. You can contest. They were his contemporaries. Of course, there is no guarantee that he was 24th. But I will not take the responsibility now. So he had never done that, seeing the point that if she says 24th, they will really kill him. But Mahavira himself had misbehaved with Makhli Gosal, who was older than him, and died before Mahavira died. And Mahavira has told a story which is so ugly that I cannot conceive that where his non-violence, his love and everything has gone. He says a story that Makhli Gosal died in a prostitute's home. Now this is absolute fiction, created by him, just to defame Makhli Gosal, that he died in a prostitute's home, and that before death he told to the prostitute that I am not the real Tirthankara, Mahavira is. But I was egoistic and jealous of him. Hence I continued whole of my life to fight for it. But now at the dying moment I want to declare the truth. And you are only here, so I am saying it to you. You declare it to others. And because my whole life I have been lying that I am the Tirthankara when I was not, and I knew it. Please make it sure, because it is my last will to you, that my body should be dragged naked in the street. It should not be carried on the soldiers as in India dead bodies are carried. 4 persons carry on soldiers the body to the burning place. My body should be dragged on the road, and everybody should spit on it, so that the whole city comes to know that I was a criminal. Now, this is absolute fiction, because Buddha does not mention it when he mentions Makhli Gosal's life. He had died, so there was no competition with Buddha. He does not mention it at all. Nothing of it. And there are other sources of the contemporary times which don't mention it. Makhli Gosal died amongst his disciples, and he has thousands of disciples, and he received the same respect as Mahavira received when he died. But that is written in other books. But what Mahavira says in his statement is a fiction, absolute fiction. And what a man of 85 years old will be doing in a prostitute's home? Just think of the absurdity of it. And who is this prostitute? The name is not given, so that she can be asked. Is there any eyewitness who saw his body being dragged? There is none. And it was the greatest city of those days, Vaisali in Bihar, where Makhli Gosal died. And the whole city was composed of his followers. Even the king was his follower. The king was one of the four persons carrying his body on his shoulders. So it is absolutely wrong and absolutely a lie. And from a man like Mahavira, who is talking about truth, nonviolence, love, that's why I say all these people, whether they call themselves messiahs, or they call themselves pegambaras, or they call themselves tirthankaras, are somehow still rooted in the ego. Very sophisticated, very polished, and very subtle, that unless you have X-ray eyes, you cannot penetrate and see the ego. Mohammedans have been asking me, are you a Peygambara? That is their word for Messiah. Muhammad was absolutely illiterate man.